ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Netanyahu stands above the carnage plotting his next big campaign, the elections that may only be 6 or 7 months away. And though he's divided Israel from top to bottom, and though he's lagging in the polls, and despite being on trial right now for corruption, Netanyahu may well win. That's the considered opinion of Aluf Ben, editor-in-chief of Haaretz, Israel's newspaper of the left. Aluf Ben later. But first, to Anna Henderson, chief political correspondent with SBS in Canberra, moonlighting for Late Night Live. Anna, welcome to the show.
Well, there certainly is a lot of moonlight around tonight, David.
Is there? Out there somewhere, gazing out the window. It'll bring wisdom to our discussion. I know Anna the Burka, what is she up to?
Well, this was flagged at the end of last sitting. So it's been on the sitting kind of set of motions for a couple of weeks now that this attempt by Pauline Hanson to bring on a bill was looming. And that was a fresh bill to kind of repeat what she tried to engineer in 2017, which is a ban in Australia on the burqa and other full face coverings. And as some of my friends have pointed out to me who've been watching this closely and who themselves wear some kind of face covering, the burqa is really, in international affairs, a very niche item. It's something that is worn particularly in Afghanistan and rarely worn anywhere else in the world. So as one person that I work with regularly said to me, this is actually a ban, if it came into effect, that wouldn't really do what Pauline Hanson wanted it to do because it's such a sort of specific definition. But in the broader sense, Pauline Hanson, who is riding high in the polls, who's having a sort of momentous public engagement post the election, has decided to sort of go full Pauline and to kind of take that extra step to try and implement this policy, widespread condemnation. But she also got what she wanted, David. She got the notoriety. She got the headlines.
She got the attention.
She stole the spotlight.
But she got the attention for race baiting. And that's useful to her?
It will have to be remain to be seen, because we discussed One Nation last week and we spoke about, you know, once people understand a little bit more about their policies beyond constraints on migration, would the support be as significant as it currently is? And the latest polling suggests that there's a pretty stable now amount of support for One Nation in the broader community. It's something that's worried the Liberal and National parties, that they're maybe bleeding votes to One Nation. I read one really interesting piece today that questioned whether or not this would be a moment where Susan Lee would be able to bring together many of the disparate forces within the opposition and actually draw a line between what the opposition represents, the possible party of government, and what One Nation actually represents with this kind of behaviour. Pauline Hanson this afternoon did a media conference outside of the Senate after she was essentially, she refused to be removed from the Senate. And so the Senate had to go into a suspension in order for her to eventually leave, because she wasn't going to comply with the direction she was given. And nobody in the major parties wanted any kind of, you know, security guards pushing her out of the room or anything of that nature. It needed to not be kind of rising to that level. But when she went out into the courtyard and had this media conference, Pauline Hanson said she was making this statement on national security grounds. Once reporters started to ask her, well, what's the evidence? What's the national security incident that's involved someone wearing one of these full face coverings? Where's the data to back it up? She directed the reporters to call ASIO or the AFP and said she couldn't specifically answer that question. And then she also said, you know, that anecdotally some people that she'd spoken to who had gone to parts of Western Sydney had been criticised for not covering up. So the argument fell apart on the sort of face of it pretty quickly once she was questioned by reporters about the substance behind this attempt.
Substance has never been Pauline's real thing. Come on, Anna. Hey, but look, help me with the image I've immediately got in my mind. So the Senate goes into recess, and does she continue to sit there in the Senate, done up in her burqa, while everybody else leaves the chamber?
I think once essentially the cameras were turned off and they went into suspension, she was quite quick to leave the chamber. On her way out, she spoke to some supporters in the public gallery. Like, this was a very planned event. Clearly, it was something that she had been wanting to do. It was a stunt that had been on the books, and, you know, there were supporters in the gallery to see her engage, and it sort of played out, I would say, in a textbook way, and as her office would have wanted it to. And the lead up to this is interesting as well, because she missed the last sittings of the upper house because Pauline Hanson was in Mar-a-Lago. She was having cocktail parties with members of the Trump administration and being involved in sort of conservative conferences discussing, you know, the sort of international movement against migration and other kind of conservative ideologies. So there has been a bit of a preamble and perhaps international discussions on some of these issues ahead of Pauline Hanson deciding to revive this stunt, which, remember, you know, back in 2017, she also had a go. I don't know if it's the same face covering that she used then, but, you know, this is a pretty well-worn playbook for Pauline Hanson.
Yep. Now, look, let us leave circuses behind here and look to the government's environment laws. What won't the government give up in order to get these laws through this week? What is non-negotiable here?
Wouldn't we like to know? I think that's one of Murray Watt's most particular kind of cards close to the chest ways of negotiating this. It's not actually clear what they won't negotiate on. I mean, I think there are some areas that I'm surprised to see the government potentially offering to work on now that only a week ago seemed to be red lines, whether it was about the national interest test or whether it was about, you know, native forest logging. So I think it's a very malleable space, and I wouldn't, at this point of these negotiations, knowing how much the environment minister wants to do this deal, even want to kind of make a statement on that. I think the critical thing for I suppose one thing that I don't see the government moving on is the idea of instating a climate trigger into the legislation. They're not willing to acquiesce to that request from the Greens. And some of the things that the opposition has been putting forward around making it easier to get the approvals through, again, I don't think that Labor wants to be in a situation where it's sort of stripped down some of the protections that it's put in there in the interests of expediency. But at the same time, I think that Murray Watt is keen to make this deal as soon as he can. The time's ticking away. We've only got until the end of Thursday, unless they extend the sitting period, to get this locked away. And both the Greens and the Coalition both see positives in waiting. They both see the potential, you know, to let the political inquiry process play out.
Run it to the wire.
Wait until next year. Not give the government the win, and also allow more scrutiny of the 1,500 pages that's been put forward. So the government's up against it, but both political parties know that they can potentially use that to their advantage as well.
Anna, remind us, how many votes does the government need from opposition parties in the Senate?
I don't bother myself with the individual numbers anymore, David.
Oh, because, 2 grand for that kind of thing.
No. Because it's in this parliament, it's a pretty simple equation. They need either the Greens or the Coalition. The crossbench is essentially out of play. They don't necessarily need any of the crossbenches to pass legislation. They just need either the Coalition or the Greens. And so that's why, in some ways, it's a more simple equation for me to think about, but it makes it a lot trickier that they don't have the ability as a government to think about how to peel off those crossbenches.
It's two blocks. It's not individual senators. It's two blocks.
Essentially. And you have the reality that these are two, you know, we would like to think fairly organised political operations. And so the government is not going in there potentially with individual concessions or horse trading with an individual senator. This is about like quite big decisions. And how they end up deciding to pass this legislation is a really different adventure that you're potentially choosing if they go with the Greens or with the Coalition to get the outcome.
In both the Greens and the Coalition, it would seem that there is a battle going on between those who want their party to be intransigent and those who want their party to negotiate. How intransigent, how strong are the intransigent forces in the Greens these days?
Well, it's a challenging internal party dynamic, and there are some who don't want to see the party sort of be seen to capitulate to Labor and give away things that it really strongly stands for. Like even the concession over the weekend on native forest logging, it's not moving to the position the Greens want the government to be. It's just providing some additional protection around native forests. So I think there is a pretty strong bloc within the Greens that want to see more manoeuvring to get to an outcome that the Greens can claim as a victory and a win, not some kind of compromise option that makes them feel paltry and that they can't campaign on. But the wicked problem for them is that one of the biggest takeouts from the last election was being a party of protest wasn't working that well for them. And, you know, they were punished, according to polling and a lot of focus group research that's been done about that election, for being a party of protest. So there is a push to try and come to the table and find points of agreement, and for the Greens to be the party that helps decide the future of environmental laws rather than it being something that the Coalition and Labor decide together and deal the Greens out, because the Greens still want to be able to say that they have a say in the parliament and that they're protecting the environment and nature. But then on the other side for the Coalition, there's sort of the school of thought, you know, let's just get this environmental protection change through the parliament so we can still campaign against net zero, but we can also say we do care about nature and we care about Australia's future.
Yes.
But I still think nobody wants to hand Murray Watt the win. Nobody wants him to be the fixer who gets it through by Christmas. And that's a pretty strong fear within both the Greens and the Coalition that in the end they're just playing into the government's hands. And it's all wrapped up together by Murray Watt just playing them off against each other, like in Parliament today, just very clearly warning them, you know, it's either you or you, and if we don't do it, then the other guys will. So it's a real mind games going on here about, you know, if one side blinks, the other side could end up getting the deal. He is enjoying it. And he's worked hard to be across the brief. But I think there's also, I think, a number of people who aren't lobbyists wanting to make money out of the outcome, but who are more in the scientific realm, who are kind of thoughtful people who are used to legislation saying, you know, it's an arbitrary deadline of before Christmas or after Christmas. The extra 3 months won't change anything dramatically about Australia's productivity, but it could mean that the laws are fairer and better. So I think that's a pretty good argument as well.
And there's the voice of Graham Samuel, who wrote the review recommending these changes, what was it, years and years ago. And there's Graham Samuel saying, just get it done. Will they listen to him?
It's interesting because when I first spoke to Professor Samuel just after the legislation was first released, and fair enough, we all had, you know, 12 hours to try and get through as much as we could of the 1,500 pages. He was very strong on, you know, I'm finding it hard to fault this legislation. It's very important that we get this pushed through the parliament and that largely this picks up on all the recommendations I made. When he came before the committee, and this is another reason why the committee process can be really important, he'd had more time to consider it. And he did raise concerns about this national interest test and whether or not it was okay for the minister to be able to essentially overrule all the environmental concerns about a project in the national interest and the definition of national interest. So he has been a little bit more muted in embracing every part of what Labor wants to achieve. But yes, his overall request, mission, appeal is that this is dealt with because he's now watched it languish for 5 years and go through, you know, Susan Lee as Environment Minister first trying to shepherd it through. There's a lot of bad blood between Labor and the Coalition around what happened when the Coalition was in government and couldn't get these laws through either. So that's another reason why some within the Coalition don't really see it as something that they have an ambition to do, to just give Labor the sign of approval on this when Labor made it hard for them in government.
Little bit of retribution.
In Parliament? No.
Oh, no. Anna, thanks for joining us on the show. I've been speaking to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent for SBS World News and moonlighting for Late Night Live. Coming up, Benjamin Netanyahu, the secret of his survival. Golda Meir and Menachem Begin were both forced from office by military disasters. The Yom Kippur War of 73 was the end of her. The invasion of Lebanon in 82 was the end of him. But Netanyahu is still there, still the centre of gravity of Israeli politics, despite October the 7th. Much has changed in Israel since that horrific day, but Aluf Ben, the distinguished editor-in-chief of Haaretz, argues that of all those changes, I quote, Netanyahu's persistence in power represents perhaps the greatest break with the status quo of Israeli history. Haaretz is Israel's newspaper of the left, published in Hebrew and English for over a century. Widely admired abroad, it's no friend of Netanyahu's government, and the antipathy is mutual. Last year, the Prime Minister pulled all government advertising from the paper, which he accuses from time to time of joining Israel's enemies to spread anti-Semitic blood libels. In a recent article in Foreign Affairs magazine, Aluf Ben examined the amazing resilience of the man who's leading Israel. Aluf Ben joins me now from Tel Aviv to talk Netanyahu, the great survivor. Aluf, welcome.
Thank you, David.
Aluf, does his survival still, despite your careful analysis, does his survival really still surprise you?
Well, at this point, it doesn't surprise me at all. It was surprising for a while, right after October 7, when, you know, the common wisdom in Israel was that no one can survive such a disaster and stay in power. But over time, Netanyahu regained his, still lagging behind, but he regained his status in public opinion polls. But I think the most important factors at play here have been, one, the fact that his foreign and security policies are widely popular, much wider than the Netanyahu's immediate support base or voters of his coalition parties. People supported the attack on Gaza. People supported the destruction of Gaza. People supported the fight with Hezbollah and the defeat of Hezbollah in Lebanon, the assassination of its leader Nasrallah. People supported the attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, aided by the United States, and this goes way beyond in the Israeli Jewish society. This goes way beyond Netanyahu's immediate support base. The only issue on which Netanyahu was at odds with the majority of public opinion was the plight of the hostages who remained in Gaza for 2 years after October 7. Now all the living hostages are back home. The dead hostages, their bodies were returned, but with the exception of three. So this issue is off the table. And the other factor supporting Netanyahu's survival is the split in the Israeli opposition. The camp that is aiming to replace Netanyahu is split ideologically and cannot agree. They cannot even, the leaders of the Zionist opposition parties cannot even agree on having their picture taken together. And they shy away from joining forces or hinting at cooperation with Israel's two Arab parties that are seen, especially since October 7, as collaborators of the enemy. And Netanyahu has been very, very successful in scaring off the opposition from posing any serious threat to Israel.
But while it's clear that his objectives are popular in Israel, isn't there a fundamental wish in Israel that such things be done well? And he has to somehow get out from under a pretty grim list, allowing Qatar to fund Hamas all those years, the devastating surprise of October the 7th, the deaths now of, it's a little over 2,000 Israeli soldiers, is it not? And the fact that Hamas is still in place. How does a leader get out from under such a list of failures?
You can add to that is ongoing corruption criminal trial that's been dragging for 5 years now, over 5 years.
I thought we'd get to that.
Yeah, no, but I mean, there's a very long list for Netanyahu to respond to. But it's been very successful so far in avoiding any independent inquiry of the war of October 7th, what had led to October 7th. And now is on the verge of appointing a government-appointed committee that will point the blame to his opponents. First of all, to the Oslo Agreement of 1993, the first Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, then Ariel Sharon's Gaza withdrawal, the disengagement of 2005. Clearly, this is little to acquit Netanyahu, because he's been in power since 2009, long after the Oslo or the disengagement, and he had plenty of time to design the protection of Israel without occupation in Gaza and military presence in Gaza, and he hasn't done so. But Netanyahu enjoys an automatic base of support of people who see him as their savior, as their warrior in social war and public war against the erstwhile elites, and they would support Netanyahu regardless. And to them, the blame for October 7 lies not with the prime minister, despite the fact that he ignored and shrugged off any warnings of war. To them, the blame lies with the opposition, with the protesters who marched in the months before the war against Netanyahu's judicial coup and chanted for democracy. He's blaming them for weakening the defense of Israel, because some of them were combat pilots and other reservists who threatened to call off their voluntary reserve service duty. And to them, they're to blame. So Netanyahu did not lose any support within his own group, besides a short while, after October 7, but then he recovered. So he starts this game, this campaign for next year's election, lying on a pretty solid basis.
But Alouf, he is under orders from the Supreme Court to set up an independent, fair inquiry into October the 7th. Yet he appears to be going down quite a different track altogether, setting up an inquiry of government loyalists to determine whether or not he and his administration were at fault on October the 7th. How does he manage simply to shift the rules in his favour in this way?
Well, first of all, he would go through the motions of appointing this patsy sort of a commission. And then there would be appeals against it to the Supreme Court. And if the Supreme Court rules against it, then Netanyahu achieves two things. First of all, he bought a lot of time. because these proceedings take a while. Second, he would once again be able to portray the Supreme Court, assuming the Supreme Court would strike down that government-appointed team. He would be able to once again portray and color the Supreme Court as collaborators of the opposition who are only there to get Netanyahu out of office. So to him, and that plays obviously to his support base. And if push comes to show, even an independent, what we call State Commission of Inquiry, whose members are appointed by the president of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, even in that condition, the mandate, the orders to the commission what to inquire and how are drawn by the government. So the government could just put on a long list of, you know, begin from Oslo or narrow it to October 7th. For example, in one case when Netanyahu and his supporters escaped the inquiry was after Yitzhak Rabin's assassination 30 years ago. The Commission of Inquiry, headed by Meir Shamgar, the president of the Supreme Court at the time, a very distinguished and respectable legalist in Israel, its mandate was narrowed to inquire about the assassination itself, the intelligence, the protection, and so on, security detail. It deliberately avoided, the government then deliberately avoided any inquiry into the incitement against Rabin and against the peace process before the assassination. So once you play with the mandate, you could pretty much determine the outcome, even if you don't control the actual nominees to the commission. So Netanyahu still has a lot of leverage here. Even if his commission is struck down, you could ask the new commission to inquire Oslo and the disengagement and go back in history, I don't know, all the way back to the Balfour Declaration or to the creation or even before the Big Bang.
We call those mandates terms of reference in this country, and we are very familiar with the power of government to draft those terms of reference to keep them out of trouble. But Alouf, has Netanyahu in his career ever been held to account for wrongdoing?
Well, he has. First of all, he ended his, during his first term, and after it, he was at the center of two police investigations for corruption. And he escaped both on a thread, but still, he escaped. He was not indicted. And then in the past 10 years, he's been going through another criminal investigation, which is now in trial for over 5 years, and he's now in the middle of his cross-examination in his own testimony for the defense. And it's going to take a long while. He doesn't like it. He uses it to portray the trial and investigation, obviously, as political tools by his opponents in the deep state to get rid of him. But besides that, the trial is painfully slow. The judges there are more or less replying and accepting most, if not all, demands of Netanyahu and his defense team. And despite that, he's been recently lobbying seriously for a pardon from the state president.
With the backing of President Trump.
Yeah, even recruited President Trump.
Yes.
To say publicly his Knesset speech when he came to declare the ceasefire in Gaza, and then writing a letter, which was probably drafted by Netanyahu or one of his aides, to President Herzog to beg for a pardon for Netanyahu from sham trial.
Sorry, does the president of Israel actually have the power of pardon?
Yes, he has the power of pardon.
Well, then it was not a wasted exercise.
No, he has the power of pardon, and due to a legal precedent from the 1980s, actually when the current president's father was the president, he can also give a pardon during the trial and even before a trial. So you don't have to wait until a conviction and then use the pardon as sort of appeal. You could stop the trial on its tracks. The problem is that in these cases, the pardoned are supposed to acknowledge that they did something wrong and repel it. And Netanyahu already announced that he's not going to admit to anything. Now, clearly to him, any pardon is going to be used as a tool to show that the trial was a sham, that it was a kangaroo court, if we go back to your country.
Yes.
Symbols, clichés, and that just begin the demand from the Netanyahu base to run an investigation against his prosecutors, against his accusers, etc., etc.
This is ABC Radio National and Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Aluf Ben, editor-in-chief of Haaretz. Aluf, let's go to that trial, the corruption trial, because, well, many things, but one is that in your paper today, there is a wonderful diagram setting out the number of days that the court has actually sat and the number of days that Netanyahu has actually turned up. And then for the days when he has actually turned up, the number of days where he gets out early by saying he has a diplomatic mission or there's something pressing or there's something. I mean, he's just running down the clock, isn't he? Isn't he doing what Trump does, so has done all his career so brilliantly, run down the clock?
Obviously, and, you know, at this pace, even if the trial ever concludes in a conviction, it might take maybe 2 more years, and then you have an appeal by either side, either the prosecution or the defense, which is going to be dragged for 7 more years. By that time, Netanyahu hopes to get rid of the attorney general, who's the chief prosecutor in Israel, and to replace the Supreme Court, the High Court, with his cronies. But this is going to take years and years and years. And I think the most important judicial victory of Netanyahu during that trial was the Supreme Court's unanimous decision several years ago, allowing him to serve as prime minister and to be on the, you know, on the defendant's box at the same time, which clearly, by showing the diagram of the, how many days he excused himself out of court, clearly, it's not as easy as they thought, but that more or less neutralized the ability of the ongoing trial to have any political consequences for Netanyahu.
Aluf, remind us about the facts of this case. This is not corruption on a Malaysian scale, is it? Or a Philippines scale. We're not talking about billions of missing dollars here. It's quite a small sum.
Well, we're not the Asian tigers here. Basically, what we're talking about are three cases. One is pretty straightforward, is getting a presence, so-called, from two billionaire friends. One, the Israeli-American film producer, Arnon Milchan, and then Milchan's friend, who also became Netanyahu's friend, the Australian tycoon, James Packer. And these guys have given Netanyahu, supplied Netanyahu and his wife with cigars and pink champagne for years, and bought expensive jewelry for Sarah Netanyahu, etc. This is one case. Netanyahu argues that this is just common behavior among friends, and
gifts from friends,
the deceased now lawyer told him that it's okay to get such presents. The other two cases involve media manipulation before the critical election of 2015, when Netanyahu was afraid of losing his job to Herzog, who is now the president, and one involves secret negotiations with the Noni Moser, the publisher of Yediot Ahronot, used to be, and Ynet, who used to be the strongest man in Israeli media for years, an opponent of Netanyahu on the surface, but a secret collaborator behind the scenes, and they negotiated a deal to help Moses' empire gain market share through some regulation controlled by Netanyahu. The other case is the most complicated one. Netanyahu actually was the de facto editor of Walla News, I think the second or now third largest news site in Israel, at that time the second largest after Ynet. And the deal was It was owned by a person who also owned the Israeli telecom monopoly at the time. And the deal, according to the indictment, was, and according to a story that first exposed by our reporter Gidi Weitz exactly 10 years ago, was to give Alovich, the owner of Walla, favorable regulation that would enrich his telecom business for billions of shekels. And then the bribe would be total control of Netanyahu of Walla, especially planting rosy stories about Sarah Netanyahu in the family and taking down stories about their opponents.
What do you reckon, Alouf? Guilty?
Well, I think he's guilty. And, we published the story because we believed it. And, it was a funny exercise in journalism, as a matter of fact. We ran a magazine story by Gidi Weitz for, 5 or 6 pages. And then were 1.5 pages of denials by all those who were asked for comments. The prime minister's office, the telecom, individual people involved. And all of them lied. Even by now, through what transpired during the trial, you could see that they just lied and lied to us. And when people ask me about truth in journalism, I tell them, you see, we published the investigative piece and then a page and a half of denials. So one has to be right and one has to be wrong. It's true and false. You cannot reconcile them. And I believe look, Netanyahu would do almost anything to stay in power.
Maybe not
the Philippines or Malaysia, but or even Russia, but he would do anything to stay in power. Media manipulation has been his trick throughout his career for 40 years.
Which of the scandals did Haaretz report?
The telecom scandal.
The telecom
scandal. The biggest
scandal.
One. The one in which he is accused of taking bribe rather than just fraud and breach of trust.
You write in Foreign Affairs magazine this wonderful analysis of the way in which Netanyahu is willing to play tough and weak at the same time. Let me read a couple of lines. Netanyahu sails through political controversies by playing heads and tails simultaneously. The same prime minister who exaggerates his power is also fine with being portrayed as the patsy of more influential actors. He doesn't care if he appears both strong or weak, as long as he can keep his seat. Now, you're talking there about America. How does that work?
Well, I'm talking about two different powers. One is the American presidency. We had Joe Biden. We had a string of Democratic presidents who've had a very bad rapport with Netanyahu. Before Biden, it was Barack Obama. And before that, going back to the 90s, Bill Clinton. With Trump, he served during his first term, and now he got him back. So one thing is that the U.S., while is Muslim, most of the time since 1948, has been willing to accept Israel's behavior or policy, or no matter how you want to call it, vis-a-vis the Palestinians, it has important regional considerations and interests that sometimes play against the wish of Israel. And first and foremost, it's the American alliance with the Gulf countries. And so sometimes sometimes the American administration and even Trump, supportive as he is to Netanyahu, would restrain him and tell him to stop this or stop that, or in that case, impose the ceasefire with Hamas on Netanyahu, just as it did in June when Israel was trying to escalate its attack on Iran and go beyond the nuclear facility to regime change and bombing regime facilities. Trump basically ordered Israel to turn its planes back. He played the operational officer of the Israeli Air Force, which is unprecedented and unbelievable, although it happened in the past, less visibly in past wars. So that's one consideration. The other consideration is the ideological base of the right wing in Israel, now personified by Netanyahu's political partners and his coalition, the ministers Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, and So he has to play between fulfilling the ideological dreams of the right wing, which during the last months of the war were openly promoting the relocation, expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from Gaza to third countries, and keep on destroying every town and village in Gaza that the IDF went through, and to all the way to supporting formal annexation of the West Bank territory into Israel proper, legal annexation, and then taking it all off the table when Trump decided on a ceasefire. So in the first case, Netanyahu appeared to be the patsy of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. And we've had not just at Haaretz, you know, we've had the entire Israeli punditry was playing that tune. And then playing the patsy of Trump against the right wing and explaining to them why he can't fulfill their ideological dreams, because he has to, Israel is, you know, relying upon the United States for its survival, for its defense, for its prosperity, and therefore you cannot say no to such a friendly president. And Netanyahu has played these tricks of head and tail and being the patsy of either side for decades. And he doesn't care. He never criticizes when they say he's weak. He likes to show, you know, I ordered this attack, I gave that instruction, and so on and so forth. But when it involves issues that are unpopular, he knows how to shy away and portray himself as weak. It doesn't matter. Mm. He's still in power.
You make the point in Foreign Affairs that the Americans have always told Israel when to stop. And what happened a few months ago in Gaza is just part of a very old pattern.
Yes, it begins in 1949, the end of the Israeli War of Independence of 48, when Israeli forces chased the Egyptian army to Egyptian territory in the Sinai, and were on the verge of encircling the remains of the Egyptian force in Palestine through the Sinai. But that offended the British, who were then the de facto rulers in Egypt and had a lot of military presence over there. They called President Truman, and his envoy went all the way to Tiberias, where Ben-Gurion, the prime minister, was vacationing, to tell him to stop and go back, turn the forces back to the international pre-war border. And the military didn't like it, but Ben-Gurion obeyed. The same happened in 1956. Eisenhower forced Israel and its allies at the time, Britain and France, to stop the Suez War, and then forced Israel out of the Sinai and Gaza, which it occupied in 4 days. 73, same thing. So you can always argue that America is saving Israel from itself, and there are some people who believe that the Gaza ceasefire was actually drafted by Netanyahu, but it was easier for him politically to appear as if it was dictated by Trump. I'm not sure. But and the truth is that it doesn't matter. What matters in politics and in public life is what you see in public and what's happening behind closed doors. And in public, America has acted as Israel's restrainer since the inception of Israel, since its independence.
And the problem here is that the Palestinian people don't engage any particular interest of the United States.
No, they don't, despite the so far, the pro-Palestinian movement in campuses and among American liberals and progressives. Well, you can make a point that it had a lot of effect on the New York mayoral election and the victory of Mamdani. But so far, the Palestinians have failed to twist the Trump policy in their direction. They got some assistance from the Saudis. Clearly, the Saudi crown prince, the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, is acting as their emissary or their sort of lobbyist in Washington by calling for, paving the way to a Palestinian state. But truth be told, we don't see much change on the ground. In the West Bank, Israeli settlers protected by the government, the right-wing government and the army, and now also by the newly appointed security service chief who came from the same the same area in the settlements and shares the same ideology. They attack Palestinian villages day and night, more or less with impunity. And in Gaza, there's very little change on the ground, despite the high words of the second stage and rebuilding of Gaza and deploying an international force. And yet, and Hamas remains in power in more or less the half of Gaza territory that is not controlled by Israel at this point. And Hamas is the de facto, the de jure, the de whatever you want, only force.
Is it your view that peace is impossible while Israel continues to occupy the West Bank?
Well, you know, the occupation is not just a practical issue. Obviously, it affects the lives of many people in a bad way. But first and foremost, and I think for all of us in Israel, post the occupation since 1967, well, I was 2 years old at the time, but growing up, I came to support that view. It's a moral problem that you have millions of people, you control their lives, control their ability to get in and out of where they live, and you don't give them political rights. And the idea of partition that goes back to the British Mandate, the 1930s, and to have two sovereign states, one for Jews, one for Palestinians, you know, it may be very difficult to achieve, but morally, it's the right thing to do because it gives civil and political rights to both sides. It demands compromise, and that's the hard part because neither side wants to let go of, I would say, the core of a lot of its ideology and beliefs, especially when religion is involved, as is the case here. So I think it's a very difficult thing to do practically because of that, of these conflicting narratives, but I think it's the right thing to do, and I also think it's practical. Look. Even after almost 60 years, Israel still cannot declare the annexation of the West Bank, despite building lots of settlements there, and hundreds of thousands of Jews live in the West Bank. It's still impossible for Israel to declare formal annexation, which means it's under control, and you know you can draw a border and relaunch peace negotiations and find a solution. Obviously, it's much more difficult after October 7th for several reasons. Israelis are far more afraid of their Palestinian neighbors. The Palestinians are far more afraid of Israeli military power. And they see that they have, as you said, very few friends across the globe to actually protect them. The Israelis also felt alone when they saw the criticism of Israel after October 7th. So it's more difficult. At the same time, both sides are far more dependent on foreign powers than ever before. The Israeli dependence on America these days and the Israeli hope of making peace or normalization, whatever you want to call it, with Saudi Arabia are greater, as great as ever. And the same is true about the Palestinians. We've always depended on external support, but I think that in their situation now, it's way more the case because Gaza is in ruins. Someone needs to rebuild it. They don't have the resources to do that. And the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is also, in the final stages of the presidency of Mahmoud Abbas. Abu Mazen was turning 80 and 90 this year. And it's too weak to control whatever it has to control or left to control in the West Bank. The idea that it could take over Gaza appears science fiction now. So, and Israeli public opinion, among the Israeli Jewish Zionist parties, nobody supports the establishment of a Palestinian state now. Even those who are warm to the idea, Israeli left, the Israeli political left, argue that it's not the time and we must wait, and so on and so forth. So it's very difficult and endeavor to promote these things.
On Late Night Live, I'm David Mann. I'm talking to Aluf Ben, Editor-in-Chief of Haaretz. Aluf, how is the press in Israel these days? I take it you get accused of spreading anti-Semitic blood libels, et cetera, fairly frequently. How's the government dealing with you? Are you still, have they still refused to advertise in your pages?
Well, you know, this was the advertising boycott was more symbolic than practical, because there was very little residual advertising of the government in Haaretz or in the Haaretz group outlets to begin with. It was more kind of a statement, and they even argued that it was not mandatory, and that because they didn't want to go through certain legal proceedings, it was just kind of a call, a declaration. Look, we have been going through the cycles of criticism in Israeli public opinion since the 1980s for reporting wars, which occur here every decade or so on average, because we've been reporting on the other side. And it was even more visible during the Gaza war, first of all, because of its length of 2 years, but also because of the level of killing and destruction in Gaza, with, you know, almost 70,000 Palestinians dead, and millions in refugee tents and shanty towns, cities and villages totally destroyed and erased. This is unprecedented. And we reported on that side throughout the war. First of all, because professionally we believe that wars have two sides. You cannot just report on one side. What the rest of the Israeli media did, the Israeli mainstream media, what did was to either to avoid reporting from Gaza altogether, or report, on occasionally on Palestinians saying nasty things about Hamas to cameras, or quoting from the international media, which in the Israeli subtext means, you know, these anti-Semites at the BBC and the New York Times, they just want us to look bad and spread these libels against us. And, you know, we don't have reporters deployed in Gaza, obviously. You can't do that. But we did call people in Gaza. We did quote from international reporting of people based there. And I think we gave our readers good journalism in doing that. But it angered a lot of people in Israel and in the Israeli government who don't want to know about allegation of war crimes. We don't want to know about how the other side feels under attack and under bombing. And, you know, in the Israeli Jewish society, the mainstream thinking for the past 2 years plus has been that the Palestinians have brought it upon themselves. They had it coming. Those who supported, who either perpetrated or supported the massacre, the looting, the rape, the destruction of October 7, cannot accept back to get any mercy from Israelis. And that really put us in a unique position, which, you know, I am very proud of, but it gets you criticized. We did not get a boycott from, for example, the Israeli military. Our reporters, you know, are embedded with the troops, and they allow reporters to get into Gaza or to the Israeli occupied areas in Syria and Lebanon. Our military correspondent Yaniv Kobovich was just yesterday in Rafah, for example. We did not get, we are invited to the prime minister's rare press conferences. We did not get a boycott and cutting of ties in terms of our reporting. But we criticize the government, and they criticize us. Part of life.
Alouf, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Alouf Ben, editor-in-chief of Haaretz. And that's the show. On our next, the unhappy economic history of Little Nauru. From great wealth to poverty in just a few decades. Now being paid millions once again to be our jail in the Pacific. Plus, the transgender soldiers of the United States fighting back after Trump tossed them from the military.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.